What we're looking at here is what's called a mandala. And Carl Jung got very interested in mandalas as symbols of completeness. And if you look at this one, which we have here, they're all pretty similar. But if you look at this one we have here, you have circle, and you have a cross, and you have the four functions in the circle and the cross. And Jung believed that he could see mandalas in the religious traditions all over the world, and in particular, he saw them in Tibetan Buddhism. Now, at the time that, so here's a whole series of mandalas on this page. At the time he was first becoming interested in mandalas, not a whole lot was known about them. So he was sort of a pioneer. One of the things that he didn't know, because he was a pioneer, was that they are not the way that they're typically represented. So for example here, this is a mandala for the Buddha Amitayu. So I'm not going to go into why they're different kinds of Buddhas. But here's the basic mandala shape, circle. It's kind of a square in there. It's divided into four parts. And in Buddhist mandalas, there's a Buddha in the center of the mandala. So Jung looked at this, and he thought that what he was seeing was something very similar to images that both he and his patients were creating in their own analytic experience. When they began to approach the self in the individuation process, which is to say approach completeness, these kinds of images, like the ones that we saw on the earlier page, started emerging in their dreams in one form or another, not quite literally like that, but if then they painted what was going on in their dreams, you'd get things that were like that. So that's how he got interested in them. And he did his own, which were very important to him. Yes, Forrest.
Do all the mandalas or whatever have the circle and the square?
Generally speaking, yes.
I just remember talking.
But they might have eight sides. Like if you actually look at this, this has eight figures in the circle here, but then it has four on the outside, and then it has a circle around that. That's the typical idea, was the cube and the sphere, or the square and the circle coming together, which indicate completeness. And so from that point of view, because these are religious symbols, completeness has something to do with religious life, spiritual life. So we've already been through that. And so that, so he was seeing these as representations of that. Now what he didn't know was that these are not actually two-dimensional. Now he may have understood this by the end of his life when he was starting to meet lamas, because after 1959 in particular, with the Chinese suppression of Buddhism and Tibetan culture in general in Tibet, as the refugees came out, some of them made their way to Europe. Jung was still alive at that time, and he, in fact, I do know, had some conversations with lamas even before that, because some had come out before that. They probably told him that actually these are floor plans, and the way that traditionally the floor plans are drawn, although this is perhaps interesting in itself, is that the walls are sort of like flop out, like if you took a cardboard box that had no top and you cut the four corners down to the base, the box would fold out, and you get roughly, by doing that, a cross shape. But really, what it was a flattened version of a three-dimensional space. In the ancient world, they didn't draw two-dimensional renderings of three-dimensional space the way our draftsmen do, the way I learned to do in high school, or the way you would see a floor plan that might be done for a house. They did them this way. They just sort of flopped them out like this. Well, Jung didn't know that. So he thought that that represented something similar to the mandalas he was familiar with. But that's not a major point, because whether they're two-dimensional or three-dimensional, and here's a version of a two-dimensional sand mandala, which is a traditional way in which they're done in sand and not just painted, whether they're two-dimensional or three-dimensional, they mean the same thing. And here's a three-dimensional mandala. Okay. And what's going on in this mandala is a little bit easier to see in this graphic representation, which was done at Cornell. I think this is a good example of it. Okay. You have a cube. You have a cross made of two what are called vajras. I won't go into a great detail about what they are, that form the base of the mandala. Then you have a building, which is technically a palace, because it's a residence of a deity or a Buddha. And you have stairs leading up to it, and then you have gateways on the four sides. Now, if we go down here to this little schematic, the four sides, which are typically four different colors, and those colors can vary depending upon the resident Buddha, and I'm going to explain all of this stuff as time goes on, right? Could be, and for example, with one that I'm particularly familiar with, have different colors. East would be white, west would be red, yellow south, green north. And this is all symbolic of something, and in the center, blue. Now, why am I going down this line in regards to mandalas? Well, from the Jungian point of view, this is just segue, it's transitional, interesting and nice. But there is something else that I want to talk about, which I think is, from my point of view, more important for this class. When we talked about the mythic journey, starting really with the Wizard of Oz, and then we talked about the way in which myths develop over time, and I used the example of Theseus and Ariadne, and the Minotaur and the Labyrinth, and how an earlier version of that was some kind of mythic structure. We can't really be sure what it is, but some kind of mythic structure that existed in a matriarchal culture and a matricentric religion on the island of Crete. In fact, it was typical throughout the whole Mediterranean world. But there were remnants in Crete at the time the Greeks encountered it, a patriarchal, patricentric culture where the gods are primary and the goddesses are secondary, whereas in Crete, the goddess was primary and the god was secondary by one hypothesis, or the alternative is that they were equal. We don't for sure know which it is. Feminist scholars like the former. I'm unconvinced one way or the other. I'll stay open-minded about it all. Although goddess-centric makes the most sense to me in truth. I just don't think that there's utterly compelling evidence. So that's the difference between my personal view and my more scholarly view, if you will, between those two things. So what we have in this story of Theseus and Ariadne and the slaying of the Minotaur and all this kind of stuff, was we have an overlay of a patriarchal myth on a matriarchal myth, which is to say we have a story that originated in one culture and is transformed as cultures change over time. And that's the main point, that myths change as cultures change. And in certain ways, the new culture has new meaning, but in other ways, it retains elements of old meaning, and things can get really confused, okay? And the impact of the trailing elements of old cultures can be quite problematic, or they can be quite positive. I mean, it's not a guarantee one way or the other. Here's an example of something that's quite problematic. In the Old Testament, you have Moses bringing down the Ten Commandments from Mount Sinai, and one of the commandments is, thou shalt not kill. Unless God tells you to, of course, because throughout the rest of the story, God is saying, slay that tribe over there to the last child because they're bad for whatever reason. He doesn't say they're bad, but he says, get rid of them because they're goddess worshiping as often as not. So it's okay to kill the enemy, be ruthless and brutal with the enemy, just within your own tribe, don't kill anybody. Unless, of course, the priests say they're bad, then you can stone them to death because they broke this law, they did this other thing, they fornicated, they ate meat on the wrong day at the wrong time, God knows what. Then you can stone them to death. I mean, all this stuff is in the Bible, okay? Now, the problem, of course, then, is we get to the 20th, 21st century, and people say, well, the Bible's literally true, so whatever is in there has to be true, right? Well, that's going to be a problem, isn't it? Because these are elements of archaic cultures that have been transmitted down to the present. Why should the mores, values, ethics, and worldview of a 3,000-year-old culture govern what we do in the 20th or 21st century? Well, you don't have too many fundamentalist Jews who believe in stoning people, but you do have fundamentalist Christians who believe that literally what is in the New Testament is true. That's another kind of problem, because the stuff that's in the New Testament is a new kind of revelation that's built on an old kind of revelation and then gets interpreted politically. So a lot of the stuff that's taken to be doctrine and appropriate scripture in Christianity is created by councils of bishops and abbots several hundred years after the death of Jesus. But then they say, this is in and that's out. Which means this is true and that's not. Which means this is accepted and that's rejected. And from that, we end up with presumptive spiritual truth. But the story of Jesus himself is somewhat typical of other myths that existed in the Mediterranean world. For example, one of the things we saw was the god Dionysus, who ends up marrying Ariadne. Dionysus is associated with cults of death and rebirth. The typical cycle of death and rebirth was understood throughout the ancient world. One of the things that was distinctive about Christianity was Jesus comes, he dies, and he's reborn. It only happens once. And by it only happening once, he opens the door for all believing Christians, for whom there will be death and there will be one rebirth, and they don't have to go through the cycle over and over again. Now, some people think going through that cycle over and over again, which is typically called a reincarnation, is okay. But in the ancient world, nobody really liked the idea. So, because in the ancient world, it wasn't too much fun, unless you were rich. And then, even if you were rich, if you got a toothache, it wasn't too much fun, you know. And if you were rich, everyone was trying to take what you had, and it wasn't too much fun. So life was tough all the way around, and the idea that you're going to get born again wasn't really very attractive to very many people. In the world of India, that's why you have all these religious developments, Buddhism, most of the yogic developments in Hinduism, which are about getting out of the cycle of rebirth. Nobody wants to be reborn. How do you get off the wheel of rebirth? That was the big thing in India. That's what Buddhism was very much all about. That was much of what the traditional yogic systems were about. How do you get off the cycle of rebirth? In the Mediterranean world, the solution to the problem was to just say there isn't any rebirth because Jesus came, and even though the story of Jesus is a very typical dying and resurrected God story, you see it all over the Mediterranean ancient world, what was different was Jesus dies and he's reborn and it only happens once. And if you are a believing Christian, then when you die, you'll be reborn. It's called the resurrection of the dead. It's only going to happen once, and you're in heaven forever. Unless, of course, you're in hell forever, which is unfortunate. But wherever you are, you're only there. It doesn't change. Now, as our scholar friend, my scholar friend, well, I never met him, but I really respect him, Edward Whitmont, has pointed out in his book, The Return of the Goddess, from which our reading comes, The patriarchal ego wants everything to be permanent and the same. Permanent and the same. Except reality isn't like that, so that's a problem. Anyway, apart from my soapbox commentary, the point here is that religions change over time and myths change along with them over time. So you can look at the death and rebirth or death and resurrection of Jesus from a variety of points of view, but one is from a mythic point of view. And under those circumstances, the story resembles many other stories with that unique distinction that I described. And that's the way the general religious mentality of Mediterranean peoples and then European peoples and then many people in the world now has changed over time. The idea of an eternal cycle, which was very much the traditional way of viewing reality in goddess-centered religions and matriarchal religions and agricultural societies, changed. It changed under the influence of the patriarchy, and we have this new idea, or this new myth, depending on how you want to see it, in which the Son of God, the divinely chosen one, dies once and is resurrected, and there's no constant cycle. So this is a significant change. You asked for us the other day about, so what does it matter whether it's patriarchy or matriarchy? Matriarchies typically are conducive to ideas of continuity and change being embedded in each other. Patriarchies typically seek the idea of no change with continuity. Okay, this is Witmot's idea, not my own, but it's a very interesting idea to contemplate. Okay, so when you have entire cultures and religions associated with those cultures where that view shifts, you can see that not only is the religion going to be different, but the way people view their existence is going to be different, and how they relate to each other and how they relate to those on the outside is going to be different as a result. Okay, so that should be pretty clear at this point. Okay, let's go back to India, and there's a reason why I've chosen to look at Buddhism, and I can see that there'll be probably, I don't think I'll get done with this talk today. We may talk about this again tomorrow, but we may not. We'll see how far we go. In the case of Buddhism, we can see a clear line of development over time, which is post-matriarchal, and is not specifically influenced by the power structure of churches and whatnot. There's kind of an internal, it's not like those things didn't happen in the Buddhist world, but there's an internal logical evolution of certain ways of looking at spiritual life and therefore the development of doctrine, which are influenced as much as anything by sort of the internal working out of the doctrines of the Buddha as the Buddhist followers experienced those doctrines over the centuries, inquired about them, because there was free inquiry in the Buddhist world, and then figuring out new things or putting new skills into practice or whatever the case may be, Buddhism developed over time. And as the culture changed, the religion changed, as the religion changed, the culture changed, they mutually influenced each other. But you did not have really strong situations, although there were political influences, you didn't have the strong situations as you had, say, in the Christian world, where you had councils of abbots and cardinals and what, well, not cardinals at that point, you have councils of abbots getting together and saying, this is the doctrine that's excluded. And anybody who's excluded is out in big and bad ways, ultimately. Okay, you didn't have that in the Buddhist world. So within 200 or 300 years of the death of the Buddha, which we're talking 5th century BC, within 200 to 300 years of the death of the Buddha, we know there were 18 organized schools of Buddhist thought that had very different views on things. They more or less got along with each other. Okay, so that didn't happen in the Christian world. There were many views about Christianity, but the Christians didn't get along with each other. And those in power got rid of those out of power. So very different. Okay, now, let's take a look at a certain thread in Buddhist thought. And I want to use this thread as a way of illustrating this larger principle about continuity and change in religion. So that's the main point here. In the same way we've talked about continuity and change of myth, I want to talk about continuity and change in core religious doctrine, because it illustrates something. The Buddha was a very practical kind of guy, if you really get right down to it. When people asked him metaphysical questions in his life, he said, I'm not going to answer that question. Or he didn't say anything at all. Sometimes he just sat there like he was a rock. He didn't say anything. The reason for this, as is generally conveyed to us through Buddhist scriptures, he says, it's not going to do you any good if I answer that question. You want to know an answer to the question of who created the world. How is that going to help you? why are you here talking to me? Do you really care who created the world or how the world was created? Does that have anything to do with the reason you're sitting here talking to me? If it does, I'll answer your question. But it doesn't. Why are you sitting here talking to me? Because you have a problem that you want a resolution to. He said the problem was one of human suffering. If we expand on that idea to say, what's the meaning of my life, which nobody asked in the ancient world, but we ask, if we expand on that and say, what's the meaning of my life, we could say in a certain way we're suffering existentially because we don't know why I'm here and what I'm doing, what I'm supposed to do. What matters? What do I care about? Why am I unhappy? What do I really want to get out of it? You know, on and on and on, that kind of thing. So the Buddha said, that question I will answer because that matters to you. And that's what I'm going to be about here. So he spent from his early 30s until the time he died, when he was about 80 years old, answering those kinds of questions and ignoring the others. So.
He died at 80?
I think he was 80. I think he lived to be about 80.
Isn't that like
a long time?
Way longer than most people lived back then?
Absolutely. I guess when you're enlightened, you get to live a long time, even in the ancient world. I'm pretty sure it was 80 years. I should know these things, like the date of his birth and death, but I've reached an age where my memory sucks for details and it's pretty good for general concepts and overview. But I'm pretty sure it was 80 years. Yeah. He was pretty creaky by the time he died, though. All right, so anyway, by one way of looking at things, by certain conventional Buddhist ways of looking at things, he was not even a human being, so when he died, it wasn't like he was creaky and arthritic and whatnot, but we're not going to go there because there are other things that I want to talk about. So anyhow, the Buddha said, look, if we want to solve the problem of why you're unhappy and why you're even here talking to me, what we want to do is we want to look at what's going on for you as a person. And because he was practical, he said, let's look at what's going on for you as a person. Let's look at your experience. Let's look at the nature of your experience. He said, if we look at your experience, we can observe certain things. And he would do this as sort of like an inquiry. He'd say, now, if such and such a thing happens, you know, he'd say, do you notice this or do you notice that? Do you feel this or do you feel that? Or do you not feel anything? So it would be very dialogic. And this stuff is recorded in scriptures, but I'm not going to do the long thing. I'm going to do the short thing. And the short thing was, as he was talking to people, he would also have some stones. And he would say, now, in your experience, do you experience something which we would call matter, stuff, this kind of thing? It was called form, technically, in the language of the times. And he'd say, you know, is there more than one kind of form, or is there only one kind of form? And what they would get to in these conversations is the realization that, you know, there might be wind, there might be water, there might be fire, there might be matter, but essentially it was all one kind of, or might be earth, it was essentially one kind of matter, it was stuff. There's only one kind of stuff. And he said, okay, we're going to call that form, and we're going to say, in that category, there's only one thing, and he'd put a stone down. He'd say, now, you have feelings, and by this, he didn't mean like sentiment, like I feel good or I feel bad. He'd say, let's observe what were called feelings. And what was noticed was that people were, in general, attracted to experiences, or they were repelled by experiences, or they kind of didn't feel anything about experiences. They were neutral. And he said, now, attraction and repulsion are really different than each other, and neutral is different from either of them. Is there anything other than those three things that are of that general nature? And people would say, no. He said, okay, now there are three things over here. I'll put three rocks over here in another pile. This is a different category than what's over here in matter. Okay. Or we could have many rocks in matter if we wanted to get the idea that earth, air, fire, and water were four different things. But anyway, those are called aggregates, and the term simply means a pile of things of a special, unique category, which is different than anything else. Okay. Then he would say, now, your experience is made up of what? And most people would say, well, I'm aware of things. And he'd say, well, let's look really closely at what you're aware of. Well, let's see, I'm aware of, I can see things. He'd say, okay, well, let's look at that. So what we would call perception, he would say, so what we notice happening here is you have an eye, you have things that you see, and you have an awareness of what you're seeing, that those three things come together. Everyone would say, right, okay. He said, now, let's go through the other senses. And so they would go through all the senses, and they'd say, oh, okay. Yeah, it turns out that for all the senses, there's an object, there's a sense organ, and then there's awareness of that. So you'd say, here's a category of perception. Is perception different than everything else, or is it the same as anything else? Well, form is included in perception, and consciousness, which is its own category, is included in perception. But perception itself is different because it's the coming together of all of these things. So he says, oh, here's a category for what we call perception. It contains different perceptions. Here's a category for consciousness. He said, now, did we miss anything? People would say, well, yeah, you know, because I have memories. And when I get up in the morning, because of those memories, I want things or I don't want things and so on and so forth. So he investigated what that was all about with people. And he created what was another category, which included all that mental stuff that we have, which are memories, predispositions, habit patterns, things which aren't material, but things which seem to have a strong influence over us. We can't just say they're mere consciousness, because in many cases we're not even aware of them. Like, are you aware of a memory until you think of it? No, but it's probably still down there somewhere. How about a habit? A habit's a very interesting idea. Habits have a lot of control over us, but try and point to one. You can't. Is it material? Well, it manifests often in your body. Is it mental? Well, then you can't see it. Where is it? Is it in your brain? Is it in your head? Well, not necessarily. I mean, physical therapists tell me we have muscle memory, we have bone memory, and we have what we consider ordinary memory. Bone memory probably isn't in your brain, it's in your bones. I didn't know there was such a thing as bone memory. But when you get old enough and you injure yourself, you discover there is bone memory, that the bones have a habit of doing certain things. We think of bones as just stiff and dry because we see skeletons and we think that's what bones are. If you went to a butcher shop and saw some freshly butchered meat, you know that bones are flexible, right? They're full of life. They're full of juice, if you will. They get desiccated and dry later. But they bend, they're flexible, and they have memory. That memory is embedded in that structure in some way which we don't really understand. Same with muscles, right? If you're an athlete, there's certain things that you train yourself to do, you learn to do, and then you don't have to pay any attention to anymore. Musicians are the same way. They work really hard to train those fingers on those keys of that piano, so they don't have to pay too much attention to that. They can pay more attention to the music, which is driving the fingers, right? Okay. So there's muscle memory, too. So where is this stuff? Well, it's who knows. So he said, so there's this category of other stuff. Anyway, the point was, he came up with these five categories, which are called the five aggregates. Now then, the other thing he pointed out to his listeners, he says, so now, is there anything missing here? And often they would say something like, well, me. I'm missing in all of that stuff. Like, where'd you put me, the subject? And he'd say things like, well, let's go looking for that me. Where is it? And people would say, well, I don't know. I experience it. He would say, like, well, is it in your body? Well, let's see. Well, yeah, my body seems to be pretty much associated with that. Then he says something like, well, I'll tell you what. Suppose you, well, just like a thought experiment, like Einstein did thought experiments. Suppose you lost your arm. Would you be any less me? Or he might even ask that question if somebody lost their arm. Were you any less you after that happened? No, I'm still me. I'm just me without an arm. So, okay, well, that means that me and body aren't exactly the same thing, are they? Okay. How about your consciousness? I mean, moderns would say, me, that's my consciousness. So Buddha would say, well, last night when you weren't having any dreams but you were sound asleep, where were you? And people would have to say, gee, I don't know. Well, where was your consciousness? Well, I don't know. Well, I guess you didn't exist last night, did you? Well, no, I definitely did because I'm here today. Oh, that must mean that your consciousness and you are not exactly the same thing, are they? Oh, yeah, no, I guess not. Okay. Well, how about all those things over there that we call feelings, as in attraction, repulsion, and neutral? Can you find you in there? Oh, no, no, no. That's I want that. I don't like that. Oh, I don't care about that. But it's I, as an agent, who am attracted or repelled. But I and the experience are two different things. Okay, so you're not over there, are you? Now we're running out of places where you can be. The one that's left is what I've called habit energy here, or predispositions, or memory traces. So they go through the analysis and the same thing. It's like, are you your habits? Are you the sum total of your habits? No, not really. I mean, you know, sometimes I feel like my habits, but I know I'm more than my habits. I can have new habits. If I develop a new habit, am I a new person? No, I'm the same person, just have different habits. Okay, that means habit and person aren't the same thing, are they? No, I guess they're not the same thing. So then the Buddha would say, okay, well, we went through all those categories of all your experience, which you just got through describing, and we couldn't find you. Do you want to take a shot at where you might be? Is there anything else? So what they come to with this kind of analysis, and this is what they did. They were very rational, practical people. I mean, they were like, you know, at the Athenian Academy. You know, Socrates is talking to people, that kind of thing. What they came to, just to sort of get to the end of this conversation, was the sense of I is something that exists when all these five aggregates come together. And it's there even though it's not in any one of them. It's not outside of any one of them. It's not outside of the sum total of the five of them. And it's not identical with the sum total of the five of them. So the Buddha said, okay, that's pretty much what people experience. So what is it? So the conclusion that they finally come to, that he leads them to in his Socratic way, is that I, the sense of I, is really a cognitive state or an idea that's superimposed on all that category of stuff. And that category of stuff can change, the habits can change, the body can change, because the body does change over time. Different states of consciousness can come and go, awake, sleep, what have you. You can be attracted to things, repelled by things. The sense of I is still hanging there, okay? But the sense of I has a kind of, I don't want to say arbitrariness, but a kind of uncertainty about it, in the sense that it's connected with all that experience. It's not the same as it, it's different than it. And you can push this analysis, and they did, to the whole question of whether I is actually agent or subject, for example, because that's the next step you would go to. You'd say, well, if this I is just sort of hanging there as this kind of label or idea associated with all these things, how can it do anything? Because we have a sense of I as ego, an agent that operates in the world. So how is this going to work? This doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. But we have come to this conclusion because we can't come to any other conclusion apart from the fact there is no I at all, which is not a conclusion anybody is going to accept. So how do we come to this conclusion? If we come to this conclusion, what are the implications of it? So then the question comes up, how does I get anything done? And they go through the same kind of analysis, right? In the end, what they end up with is that I is something that exists when all these things come together. And when you die and these things cease functioning, there's no more I. Now that gets into some interesting questions about rebirth and whatnot, but I don't want to go down that line because this isn't a class on Buddhism. So this is the way they understand the nature of the personality, these five aggregates. And this is the basis for Buddhist thought for a long time. Now, different Buddhist schools of thought refined this idea a little bit. Like, well, I is really a memory, and that's what's superimposed on the skandhas. Or I is sort of a subjective consciousness, it's not a memory, and that's superimposed. I said skandhas, I mean aggregates, that's a Sanskrit word for it. And I is superimposed on them as a state of consciousness. It's not really a memory. So they debated these kinds of things, okay? But the thing they all agreed on was that the person is made up of parts. which are dynamically related to each other and constantly changing over time. And that that was the reality. And that all this concatenation of parts changing over time with the label I appeared to be a solid entity to most people. It appeared not to change. I mean, you don't think of yourself as changing. You don't think of yourself as changing. I don't think of myself as changing. My wife has a picture of me when I was 5 years old sitting on our bureau, right? I don't look like that. Definitely something's changed, okay? My mind is very different, you know? Truth of the matter is we change from day to day, moment to moment. Our scientific friends tell us that there's not one part of your body that was around more than 7 years ago, that all of your atoms have recycled over a 7 year period. All the cells of your body change over a 7 year period. Maybe not one atom is extreme, but all the cells of your body have regenerated over a 7 year period. That's a pretty significant change, okay? But we still feel the same. Same old me around here, right? Even though the fact of the matter, if we investigate it, is on what basis can we say such a thing, right? But we do, okay? We do. So the Buddha said, okay, fine. Now, there are implications of that from the point of view of liberation, getting off the cycle of existence and whatnot. Again, I'm not going to go down that line because that's not the point. The point is the idea of a solid entity is agreed upon by Buddhists as a solid entity of a person is agreed upon by Buddhists for hundreds of years as we don't accept that. We know that that's a fiction. Even though the way it's a fiction might be something we debate. We know it's a fiction, and it's sort of true and sort of not true in a certain way, okay? So we can be okay with that idea. Then it started occurring to some of the Buddhist philosophers that, now wait a minute, these parts here, which are called the aggregates, are they solid? I mean, so in the Buddha's teaching, he didn't really go down to that place. Like, are the parts of your body really solid and permanent or not? Are they really what they appear to be? He was more interested in, let's just look at what you think is you and try and figure that one out. But the Buddhist philosophers had time on their hands and they were thinking. So they started asking this question. Also, they meditated a lot, so they looked at it directly. Oh, wait a minute. Are the parts made up of parts? Are the aggregates, the categories with the stuff in them, are those little bits of stuff, the stones that were set aside by the Buddha, are they made up of parts? Are they any different than the person, or is their what we would call their ontological status the same as the person? Well, the Buddhist philosophers looked at that, and some of them said, no, you can't divide those things up. But mostly, the view that was developed was, yeah, you can divide those things up. Now, in the West, just to go back to something we're familiar with, you know, the discovery of atoms as what was the basis of all things that existed was kind of revolutionary. It was a big deal. And for a long period of time, people didn't think that you could divide an atom. They figured that that was it. You couldn't get any farther than that. And then lo and behold, they discovered, whoops, atoms are made up of parts. Oh, isn't that interesting? Neutrons, electrons, protons. Well, okay, so you can't divide those things up. Whoops, you can divide those things up. And when you divide those things up, there are more parts down there. And you can divide those things up. And every time they keep looking for the thing that you can't divide up, they find that you can divide it up. They can't seem to find an end to it. Finally, you get to the place where you're not even looking at stuff anymore. You're looking at probabilistic relationships of potentially energetic situations in a certain space and time, which is changeable depending upon where you, the observer, are. And that as soon as you observe it, isn't in that place and time anymore. Okay, that's really dividing things up pretty far. But guess what? You can divide that up too. There's no place where this dividing process really can end that we can find for sure. I mean, we seem to have reached a point where we can't divide things up anymore. But that's probably only because we haven't figured out a way to divide it up some more. Because if we look at our past history, every time we think we've gotten someplace where we can't divide it up anymore, we can divide it up some more. So maybe that'll be the future too. Well, the Buddhists sort of noticed this through their meditation. And they said, So that means all those things out there that we can identify as things are just like persons, aren't they? They're not solid, they're not fundamental. they're changing dynamics, something, we don't know exactly what, but not solid and fundamental. So that was a revolution in Buddhist thought, which was a shift from the person is not solid and permanent, but the parts of the person are solid and permanent, to nothing is solid and permanent. Now, when you go to nothing is solid and permanent, that has some pretty interesting consequences. It's a very different way to understand your existence in the world, to not just understand that you're not solid and permanent, but that your parts aren't solid and permanent. If you think your parts are solid and permanent, that's one thing. But if you think your parts are not solid and permanent, now that's another thing. The Buddhists split over what they decided was going to be the case. The parts are permanent and solid, or the parts are not permanent and solid. Okay. And so within Buddhism, a division began to emerge. There were other reasons for it, but it was a naturally emergent division into what was called, later, called the Hinayana schools of Buddhism and the Mahayana schools of Buddhism. Technically, what that term means is yana means vehicle, maha means great, hina means small. And the reason they chose the word vehicle is in the ancient scriptures, the Buddha says that my teaching is like a raft that will convey you from one shore across the river to another shore. The shore you're on now is the shore of suffering and confusion. The shore you want to be on is peace. And my teachings will get you across the raging river of your mind and experience the shore of peace. And then he said, so that's the vehicle, that's the yana. The great vehicle is all-inclusive of everything. The small vehicle is less inclusive, more oriented toward individuals. So I don't want to go down that particular line, but this was the distinction. The other thing that he said, and I'll close the talk with this, was when you get to the other shore, when you've crossed the river, let's say you're walking through the jungle and you come to a river in India, and you want to get across, and you don't know how to swim, or maybe it's a big river and you can't swim across it, and you see there's a boat tied up on the shore, and there's a sign there. Let's say there's a sign there, and you could read the sign, and it says, this boat is for getting to the other side. Make free use of it. Oh, great. So I'm not stealing it. I get in the boat. I paddle across the river. I get to the other side. What do? I tie it up and leave it there, throw it over my shoulder and carry it, just in case I happen to run across another river in the next 500 miles? No, you leave it in the water. So the Buddha said, when you get to the other shore, you don't need my teaching anymore. Leave it behind. That's a very interesting religion when he says something like that. My religion, he didn't call it my religion, my teaching is good for getting to the other side. When you get to the other side, you don't need it anymore. Leave it behind. Don't take it with you. If you take it with you, it's a burden. You don't need it. Okay. All right. So now we have this revolution. And that's where I'm going to leave it at this point. Because what I want to pick up with tomorrow is then a third revolution, which gets us to looking at mandalas and where the mandalas come from. Okay? So I didn't finish today, but that's okay.